You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Joint Council 56 and United Auto Workers Local 249. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And United Auto Workers, Local 249, members building the best Ford trucks and vans in the world. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, when Harley-Davidson announced the shutdown of its Kansas City plant, they blamed declining motorcycle sales. Is that it? Well, we'll ask two union presidents if there's more to the story. Then, March Madness and the NFL draft are in full swing. We'll ask sports historian Chuck Ross if athletes are getting a fair shake, or was LeBron James right when he called it a corrupt system? In the news, tipped employees win a victory in Congress, and yesterday's rally in Jeff City against right to work for less. Our feature at the end of the show is a special commentary about football players and concussions from Chris Mann. Now for the news.
And this is the news from our side, March 29th, 2018. Rock United, that's the Restaurant Opportunities Council, is celebrating. They say, in the face of unbelievable odds and powerful opposition by the National Restaurant Association, that's the other NRA, we won bipartisan support of tip protection legislation for tipped workers throughout the entire country. It is now a matter of federal law. Tips belong to the workers, not their employers. Rock United began mobilizing after the Trump Labor Department proposed a rule that would have allowed employers who pay the full minimum wage to keep their workers' tips, essentially making tips the property of employers. Remember, the full minimum wage nationally is just $7.25 an hour. So, say you work at Denny's and customers have no idea whether your boss pays you the tip minimum, which hasn't budged since the early 90s and is still at $2.13 an hour, or pays you the regular minimum. You leave a tip and the Denny's boss might get to keep it for himself? No one should be surprised that NRA would push for that. But the U.S. Department of Labor, under a president who daily chortles about how pro-worker he is? Well, even a bipartisan group of congressmen could see how outrageous that proposal was and put a stop to it. Of course, it took a movement to get them to see the light. As Rock reports, throughout the country, hundreds of thousands of restaurant workers and allies submitted over 400,000 comments opposing the proposed rule, testified on Capitol Hill, and held actions at DOL and Restaurant Association offices. Due to the outcry from working people and allies, Congress included an amendment to the Fair Labor Standards Act and the Omnibus Spending Bill. The bill, which was signed into law, states that employers, managers, and supervisors can never take tips, And if an employer steals a worker's tips, they must pay you back not only double the tip stolen, but the employer then also retroactively loses the privilege to pay a subminimum wage to tip workers and must pay back double any amount claimed towards the minimum wage. The bill does allow mandatory tip sharing with the back of the house employees. Rock United concluded, this was not a matter of chance, but the result of sustained organizing and the power of working people uniting. This victory demonstrates that organizing works and that we can win, even in the Trump era.
PAI reports from Portland that Oregon AFL-CIO President Tom Chamberlain, accompanied by other union and community supporters and a delegation of about a dozen Burgerville workers, paid a visit the company's Vancouver headquarters March 26 to deliver a message. Burgerville Workers Union has majority support at Burgerville's Southeast 92nd Avenue and Powell location in Portland. And if the regional fast food chain doesn't voluntarily recognize the group within 2 days, the union will ask for a government-administered union election at that site. But when they arrived on foot at the headquarters building just after 1 p.m., the delegation found doors locked, desks near the windows unoccupied, and no one to come to the door. After talking through a locked glass door to someone who appeared in the lobby, they taped their demand letter to the front door and departed. Burgerville is a privately owned regional fast food chain with 42 stores. It promotes itself as local and sustainable, but pays workers at or near minimum wage. Burgerville Workers Union is calling for a $5 an hour wage increase. Union activists believe they have majority support at the 92nd and Powell location, and this will be their first call for an official union election since they publicly launched the union campaign in April 2016. If they ultimately win, they would be one of the first groups of fast food workers to unionize in the United States. But the union supporters emphasize their union exists as an organization of workers, regardless of whether it has the support of a majority. They're asking for a vote because demonstrating majority support in an election administered by the NLRB would obligate the company legally to negotiate with the union. We already function as a union, says Mark Medina, a union supporter at 92nd and Powell. This is just to make the company sit down with us. Since February 2nd, Burgerville Workers Union has been calling on the public to boycott the company until it comes to terms with the union. The boycott has so far been endorsed by 19 unions as well as by other organizations and individuals.
On Wednesday, hundreds of workers from Missouri rallied in Jefferson City against so-called right to work, which will be Proposition A on either the August or November ballot in Missouri. The rally was organized by the Missouri State Building and Construction Trades Council and called a rally for the middle class. Speakers were Senate Minority Leader Gina Walsh, Representative Clem Smith, Senator Jake Hummel, State Auditor Nicole Galloway, and retired Roofers Local 20 member Walter Smith. Heartland Labor Forum's own Ariana Eckel lifted her lovely voice to sing both Solidarity Forever, Labor's Anthem, and Union Maids. The Missouri Times reports that Bob Voitman, an electrician from St. Louis, made the trip because he's against right to work. He said, it will hurt my wages and the wages of every Missourian. Jake Hummel, who is a state senator as well as secretary-treasurer of the Missouri AFL-CIO, said, referring to the 310,000 signatures labor gathered to put Prop A on the ballot, when a union man or woman has a job to do it, and we get it done. He said, their job now is to defeat Proposition A on the ballot. We cannot fail, because if we do, the people in this building, that's the state capitol, the people that want to take away our rights, cut our pay, give our jobs to someone else, they won't let up. They won't stop. Hummel told the crowd, they will keep coming back to you for you and for your family's way of life. To his point, one individual in the crowd was holding a sign that read, why are out-of-state contractors working on my capital? Keynote speaker Senator Claire McCaskill said, it is a very simple principle that men and women can join together and collectively have a voice in their wages and their benefits. It is the labor leaders that came before you that struggled and fought for a safe working place, for decent wages, for benefits you can count on. It is, in fact, the labor unions in this state that have made the middle class work. Only an elitist would think it's a good idea to remove power from the worker. Only someone who is looking to give money to shareholders and not money to families would be in favor of removing the power of the worker. The right to work referendum is currently scheduled for the November election. However, Republicans in the legislature may push to move the vote up to the August election. McCaskill said they actually think if they move this election to August, that all you guys won't vote in November. This is how little they know about you. The news tonight was read by Jen Zaman, Tino Scalisi, and I'm Judy Ansel. And here's Ariana singing Union Maid at the rally yesterday.
There once was a union maid who never was afraid of the goons and the ginks and the company finks and the deputy sheriff who made the raid. She went to the union hall when a meeting it was called, and when the company boys come round, she always stood her ground. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union till the day I die. This union maid was wise to the tricks of the company spies. She couldn't be fooled by a company stool. She'd always organize the guys. She always got her way when she stuck for higher pay. She'd show her card to the National Guard, and this is what she'd say. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union till the day I die. You women who want to be free, just take a little tip from me. Break out of that mold we've all been sold. You've got a fighting history. The fight for women's rights with workers must unite. Just roll them bones like Mother Jones to the front of every fight. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union till the day I die.
Woo! And that was Ariana Eckel, apprentice electrician, member of IBEW 124, singing for the rally yesterday in Jefferson City. I'm Judy Ansel, and our show now is going to address the issue of Harley-Davidson. When Harley-Davidson announced it was shutting down its Kansas City plant at the cost of 800 jobs, the newspapers all echoed what Harley management said, that it was due to declining sales and overcapacity. Harley just wasn't as popular as it used to be. Baby boomers were past their Harley prime, and succeeding generations either had less disposable income or to spend on expensive Harleys or less interest. Harley, of course, is an iconic American company, and many who buy their motorcycles love the imagery and the American-made label. Harley also enjoyed warm feelings because it had a reputation for treating its workers well. It talked partnership and teams and decent compensation with good benefits, at least until 2011, when it dropped all that and started pitting its three plants against each other for concessions. After the unions in the Kansas City plant signed the third of three concessionary agreements for Harley's U.S. plants, Keith Wandell, president and CEO of Harley, said, quote, "Together with our unions, Harley-Davidson is making the necessary changes across all our production facilities to succeed in a competitive global marketplace. The company is well on its way to building a world-class, sustainable, lean operating structure." World-class, sustainable, and lean. Well, we'll find out from our guests what that means. Harley was also all-American in another way. It loved to feed at the public trough and gobbled up subsidy after subsidy. Indeed, extortion was how they came to Kansas City, gaining $6.4 million initially, which grew into many more millions. Just looking at what Harley ingested locally, It was $100 million plus in bonds from 1996 to 2001 from Kansas City and Platte County, close to $37 million in tax credits for rebates from the state of Missouri from 2000 to 2003, and over $5 million in reimbursements for training from the state between 2001 and 2013. Harley also got big subsidies for its Wisconsin headquarters and plant from Scott Walker and previous governors. Your federal tax dollars worked for Harley, too, to the tune of $2 billion, $635 million from 2008 to 2009 in federal loans and loan guarantees to help it withstand the Great Recession. So, I think it's fair to say that Harley, the iconic American corporation, the welfare queen, has lived off its workers, its customers, and the taxpayers. They truly have realized the American dream. In 2016, after Harley had extracted concessions from its workers and laid some off, abandoning its celebrated partnership with the unions, I interviewed Kevin Amos and Brent Farr, presidents of Harley's two union locals, IAM, that's Machinist Local 176, and Steelworkers Local 760, about how work life had changed at Harley. I have to add that we won a prize for that show, too, from the International Labor Communications Association. Tonight we have them back. We'll explore with them what went wrong at Harley and why Kansas City is the one to shut down. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in. So, is it falling demand because of aging baby boomers? Is that the whole story? Why else is Harley in trouble, do you think?
There's probably a multitude of reasons. Baby boomers is one of them. They've definitely supported the company for a number of decades. Millennials is a huge issue. How do you market to those folks?
They don't have the money? Is that it?
Well, I'd say they don't have the money and probably don't have the interest in the product being put out.
Mm-hmm.
There has not been a market that they're interested in. Harley-Davidson continues to put out the same motorcycle, different colors, a little bit more chrome.
This reminds me of Henry Ford, who said, "You can have any Ford you want as long as it's black." Is this, you can have any style of motorcycle as long as it appeals to baby boomers?
Well, it appears that way, but you know they've promised the market that there's going to be a whole bunch of new models coming out within what 5 years, right? A 5 year span.
Yep, 5 to 10 years.
But. You know, who knows what they'll look like. Maybe they'll capture it, maybe they won't. But long story short, what's happened from when they were great and there was a large backlog to where they are now is poor decision-making from the very top.
Really?
It, from my opinion, yeah, absolutely.
Is that what your folks are saying too, Brent?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. So what do you think they should have done different? It sounds like they should have designed bikes that would be more appealing to younger folks, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, but what does that mean? I mean, you know, what do they want that's different, do you think? Do you have any idea?
That I have no idea, but when there's a demand for your product, you don't put so many out there that the demand diminishes.
And they have overcapacity, right? There's a lot of them sitting around waiting to get bought.
Yeah, well, absolutely. That's correct. Why Kansas City's closing.
Yeah. Okay. Although, you know, we'll get to why Kansas City and not York, Pennsylvania, or the Wisconsin plant. But anyway, I want to go back to the concessions that you guys negotiated in your last contract, which was, by the way, a 7-year contract, I think. It introduced temps and casuals and a multi-tier workforce. Brent, could you tell us about what that looked like?
So, beginning of the year, usually January to May or June, we would have what they call surge. And at that time, they'd bring in a bunch of casuals. It could be anywhere from 200 to 300 part-time workers to work for that time period. And we just built, you know, X amount of motorcycles.
Did they work for Harley?
They came in as temps through an agency, and after a 9-week span, then they converted to an HD casual, which was still a part-time worker with no benefits and less pay.
Were they union members?
Yes.
But not they weren't under your contract then? Or they were under your contract, yeah. But they didn't get the same benefits as you
Correct.
Did. Okay. And so how many tiers actually were there? Just two?
Just two.
Just you guys in the casuals?
Yes.
Okay. So let me just ask, what's happening with the layoffs then? Who are they all getting cut, or have they already been cut?
No, they have not. We are currently in surge again till June. And
people buy motorcycles in summer, is that it?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
So with surge, they've flooded the market with, the early part of the year and with bikes that weren't selling. And then, of course, we kept building through the end of the year, which also caused a lot of down days and down weeks in the back half of the year as well.
What, you were laid off?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Okay, so now with the shutdown, I know that different people, different categories of workers are getting different kinds of benefits, and you've negotiated a whole severance package. But I'm curious to know what in particular is going to happen to those casuals. Are they going to have any rights at all?
So within the new agreement that was ratified on February 20th, there will be a large portion of the casuals that will be converted to full-time employees.
Oh, really?
Yes. Okay. And there will no longer be casual employees utilized in Kansas City.
Okay. Well, so then a good number of these folks are actually going to be able to get the same benefits as you guys?
Yes. So the company desires to maintain a certain headcount throughout certain time frames.
And otherwise they'd leave, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So they're going to be in full production then until their closing date is what, summer of 2019, is that it?
Projected, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay, and we'll get more to your severance agreement in a minute. But I want to ask, what was the effect on morale when you gave those concessions? I know you got pitted against the other two plants and threatened that they were going to close at that time and move all your jobs to one of the other plants. So what was the impact? Did that actually save Harley money? Was that like a good strategy for Harley to try to recoup, or was it a disaster?
I don't believe it was. I believe that the way they kept making money was by what they would call right-sizing the company, getting rid of, higher-paying salaries and all that. They still weren't selling the motorcycles.
So, and you guys took pay freezes or pay cuts, right?
Yes, we was 4 years without a pay raise.
4 years.
Yep.
Okay. And they got rid of the teams and introduced supervisors, right?
Correct.
Right. And so how did that affect the functioning of the place? Or efficiency? Did it make it more efficient?
I don't believe so, no.
Uh-huh. So the big savings that the company thought they were going to get, you don't think they got?
I haven't seen figures, and Mark Twain said, about statistics, there's liars, damn liars,
right,
and statisticians.
Yeah, okay.
There's no way to really tell.
Uh-huh. Were people pissed off?
Absolutely.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So morale was not so hot?
Oh, no.
It's been bad for 7 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, people.
Has there been a lot of turnover?
In the last 7 years, there's been a lot more turnover than there ever was in the first 15 years.
Yeah. This is such a familiar story in terms of American plant shutdowns, where the employers first come to the workers demanding concessions, and workers who are facing, total job loss generally give in to those concessions. And management pulls out as much extra profit as they can from those workers, and then they dump them. And, I'm just thinking of the story of the General Motors Leeds plant and the Chevy plant in Kansas City, which shut down in the late 80s. Same scenario. And it turned out they were the most productive plant that made the J-car at the time, and they were the ones who got shut down. You can't even... you put your heart into saving your job, and those decisions are made on a whole different level. So let me ask you, why Kansas City?
Really? I don't know. I really don't know. My head still reels. If it were my business to run, I probably would have made a different decision. Mm-hmm. Probably even if I lived in Milwaukee, I would have made a different decision, knowing what I know. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's no shot at our brothers and sisters at York, Pennsylvania. It's just knowing what we know. So I don't understand why they chose Kansas City, but that's the choice that they made.
It was their newest plant, right?
Yeah. Yes. Now, they've made a lot of capital investment in York, Pennsylvania recently that they have not made in Kansas City.
Huh. But the plant wasn't that old.
Correct.
Right. I mean, when was this plant started?
1997,
right. Okay, well, does it have anything to do with Harley's international strategy? Because I looked up, you know, what kind of plants Harley has internationally besides its four plants. And I guess it's four plants. There's two in Wisconsin, or one's a parts plant or something. Yeah. And, you know, overseas they have plants in Australia, which you guys just told me is shutting down. Brazil, India, and Thailand. And they say all motorcycles sold in the U.S. are made in the U.S., rah-rah, but that the foreign plants are for foreign markets. And your president, Brett, Leo Gerard of the United Steelworkers, said, why couldn't we build them in the U.S. and export them? He's worried that Harley will start pitting U.S. workers against the Asian ones, the ones in Thailand or India, just as they pitted one plant against another here. And also, your president, Kevin, Robert Martinez of the Machinist Union, said it's a slap in the face to the U.S. workers who built an American icon. According to the New York Times, Harley's new business model is to expand its international sales with bikes made outside the U.S., especially for the China market, with bikes made from kits in Thailand. They blame tariffs for this, and it's clear that rather than produce in the U.S. and export to China, Harley will build motorcycles in Asia, for Asia, and even for Europe. So what does made in America mean anymore? Is it, you know, like we demand made in America products, but is it just made in America for America? What do you think about it?
So Harley's mystique outside of this country is because it's American. And because of the image, mm-hmm. that American raw image, you lose that at some point when those motorcycles are knowingly being produced outside of the country.
Out of kits, what does that mean, out of kits in Thailand? Do you know?
So we actually put them together in Kansas City.
You're kidding.
No. And then they put them in kits and ship them over and where they are assembled.
Uh-huh. So now they're going to do that from York or something?
Yeah. Well, and York is doing it as well.
As well, yeah. So it is sort of made in America then, huh?
Yes.
Yes.
Indirectly.
Jeez. Okay. Okay. Yeah, you really do wonder what their business plan is. Okay. So we don't have a whole lot of time left. Just real briefly tell us what you got in the, it's called effects bargaining when you bargain for your severance. So what are the highlights of that?
So wage increases for the workers for the duration of the contract that were effective beginning of March.
Finally, huh?
Yeah, finally. Thank goodness. Increased severance package for folks when they're leaving. Let's see.
So what's a typical severance package?
So go ahead.
I was going to say part of it was also with a relocation.
You could move, right?
To York, yeah.
Yeah, how many of you are going to do that, do you think?
Maybe a handful at best, I would
Not
say.
Many, huh? Not
Who
many.
Who would want to leave Kansas City?
All right, for Pennsylvania?
Beautiful city.
That's right. Okay, so like, do you know how much severance one of you guys will get? You've got how many years there?
I have 16 years, 17
And it depends
years
on your seniority, right?
Yes, years served.
So do you know how much you're going to get?
But I haven't even calculated it.
Oh, okay. It's substantial, though, right?
It's decent, yes.
It's decent.
Yeah.
So it'll help with the transition. But, okay, I'm going to leave that at that because, Brent, I wanted to ask you, you know, what are your members saying about this? What's the feeling?
Well, a lot of them are obviously disappointed. You know, they believe that a lot of them started when they was 18, 20, 22 years old. One of the only places they ever worked. They always figured they would retire from there. And, you know, now they're not. You know, they have
kind of pulls the rug out from under them, doesn't
yeah.
it? Are they optimistic that they're going to find comparable jobs?
I would say a lot of them are, you know, but there's still the unknown, right? Which is, that's what people are scared of, is the unknown. I don't know what I'm going to find. They do know that the employment area is good in Kansas City and the surrounding areas.
Right, but there aren't that many unionized plants that are hiring.
Correct.
Do you have many members who are over 50?
Several.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose they're the most worried.
Yeah, they are.
And Kevin, are you guys going to get any kind of retraining that you know of?
Yes, we're working with AFL, Missouri AFL-CIO.
Okay. And that would be under trade adjustment assistance if you can qualify?
Yes.
Okay. And that's an unknown at
Correct.
This point. Okay. Well, I want to thank you guys very much for coming in, and we'll keep tracking this story.
All right.
We've been talking to Kevin Amos, president of Machinist Local 176, and Brett Farr, president of Steelworkers Local. It's escaping me here. What's your local number?
760.
760. Okay, I knew it was a 7. Anyway, thank you both very much for being
here. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Jacob White. Welcome back to Heartland Labor Forum. And joining us today on the show is historian Charles Ross. We've had him on a couple of years ago to talk about Mavericks, Money, and Men, the AFL, Black Players, and the Evolution of Football, which was a really interesting book about, it had some Kansas City knowledge about it. And today we're going to talk about a couple different things about college sports and professional sports and how much progress we still have to make. So thank you for joining us this morning, Dr. Ross.
Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you again.
I would say, if you don't mind, if we start with the Chiefs, it's been an interesting offseason for the Chiefs. We traded away one of the best cornerbacks in football to the LA Rams, Marcus Peters. And there was comments about how that didn't necessarily reflect his play on the field. Do you have any comments on that, Dr. Ross?
Well, I don't know if I have any kind of specific information. I know that he was a young man, I think, that was committed to some of the protests that were taking place by NFL players at the time. And the young man, Reed, it has not been signed yet, so there's a lot of speculation that maybe there may be a collusion among the owners to kind of penalize those players that they felt were pretty much kind of out front on maybe their respective teams. And so he could be paying a price. You're probably going to have a difficult time being able to prove that. Everybody's going to simply say that, you know, opportunity is going to maybe, you know, facilitate itself at some point down the line, and he'll get an opportunity if there is a team that has a certain need. But clearly, phenomenal defensive back, and the fact that he hasn't been signed raises some eyebrows around, you know, from anyone that has any kind of logical approach or thought process as they look at what transpired during last season.
And websites and news sources that aren't even considered, you know, in any way conspiratorial are talking about how Eric Reed is 26 years old. No other safeties are really getting signed right now, and people are legitimately saying that that's so that it doesn't look like they're colluding against Reed. Does that have credence? Do you think so?
Well, let's see. Let's see how the rest of the offseason. I think we need to let's see how the rest of the offseason plays itself out. I think there has been, a lot of analysis that safeties haven't necessarily been signed. That. They tend to be kind of the lowest paid in terms of in the secondary. Let's see. One thing we do know that Eric Reed can play in the National Football League at a level in which he can make a very strong contribution in helping his team win on the defensive side of the ball. I don't think there's any question about that. So the idea that he not get signed by anyone as a result of the off season that's getting ready to take place, I think would challenge that argument that there's no collusion. And listen, let's be honest here now. I mean, if Colin Kaepernick has not had an opportunity to play in the National Football League, clearly NFL owners are not exonerated from the fact that they have decided to make examples of certain players. And so Colin Kaepernick is the first player to pay that price. And so I would not be surprised if there are other players that have to pay that same kind of ultimate price and not get an opportunity to play on the field.
The Chiefs signed Chad Henne to be our backup quarterback this year, and I don't think you can make the case that he's better than Kaepernick or that he's, you know, the same type of quarterback as Mahomes or any of these other arguments. So, yeah, it's another frustrating offseason for Colin Kaepernick.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the Chiefs are a very interesting team. They had a very good run beginning of the season. You know, anytime you can beat New England in the fashion that they beat New England, I think there was a tremendous amount of optimism as the season wore on, particularly when they played the Pittsburgh Steelers. I think that began to see that there were some issues kind of on the defensive side of the ball. I think that they really began to have some struggles being very physical on the offensive side of the ball. Very interesting that, ultimately the fact that you move up and you drafted the young man out of Texas Tech and you have to now try to make a trade and you move where you allow Smith to go to Washington was something that, when the season takes place next year, it'll be very interesting to see how Andy Reid is going to be able to hold up if the young man from Texas Tech doesn't pan out, because you gave up an established veteran who really didn't do anything that warranted any kind of necessary major criticism, nor said that he needed to move to another team. I know that politically, when you draft, you move up and you get a young quarterback, you got to let that person play. But there have been situations in the NFL where, certain teams have allowed individuals to sit on the bench for a little while. And so we'll see how it works out. Hopefully it works out. But you're right. I mean, Chad Henne is no Colin Kaepernick, and now they're going to start a rookie quarterback for the most part. It'd be very interesting to see whether or not they're going to what direction the Chiefs go. Do they continue to build on the number of wins that they had last year with this very savvy veteran quarterback, or do they take a step back?
And there's a history of not taking a step back when you go from Alex Smith to Colin Kaepernick also, so yeah. Maybe that was part of it too.
That's true.
But speaking of young quarterbacks, I wanted to touch a little bit about Lamar Jackson, and I read this article, I don't know if you saw it, talking about how it's good that Lamar Jackson, who won a Heisman Trophy at quarterback, is working out as a quarterback. It's good that teams wanted him to try another position, and then a list of other quarterbacks who are athletic and should have played another position that included Chad Kelly, Jeff Driskel, and Connor Shaw, who are three white former SEC quarterbacks who did not make it as quarterbacks in the NFL. But I wanted to know if you had any thoughts about the way that Lamar Jackson has been, asked to switch positions and maybe, bring us a little more substance about the history of black athletes at quarterback.
Well, I mean, we've come a long way, since Michael Vick, finally kind of broke through that glass ceiling, being the first African-American to be drafted number one at the quarterback position. Prior to that, you had a lot of individuals that clearly had the talent, but because of the way the quarterback position was being analyzed or really kind of set aside in a certain sense, that the African-Americans didn't have ability intellectually to read defense and so on and so forth. And so, we'll have to see what happens with this young man. I watched him in the bowl game against Mississippi State He made several really kind of bad throws, left out of that game with five interceptions. Hopefully, if he can maybe, maybe that was an enigma, maybe it was a situation where, everybody has bad games. It'll be very interesting to see whether or not he actually has moved. I don't know if he has the ability to move the wide receiver, or maybe, some kind of slot receiver or something like that. But I do think that based upon his body of work, I think he does deserve the opportunity to go to camp, see if he can produce or at least read defenses, have an opportunity maybe even to sit on somebody's bench and to be groomed, and who knows what's going to happen, after 2 or 3 years of him maybe polishing his overall fundamentals and his ability to grasp maybe the playbook and the intricacies of NFL defenses. So he probably needs to go to the right situation, maybe where they have a veteran quarterback, place maybe like Pittsburgh, maybe somewhere even like New England where, the quarterback is going to be there maybe another year or two. And then maybe have an opportunity. Maybe he may be someone that can only maybe just be a backup. But I do think he has the ability in terms of his arm and his ability to move around, to have the chance. I think he deserves the opportunity to see can he play in the National Football League at the quarterback position.
Switching topics a little bit, it is March Madness, and here in KC, a lot of people are excited. I'm excited that the Jayhawks are in the Final Four. Not really looking forward to playing Villanova, but, at least we're at this level. And this is a topic that, Heartland Labor Forum has covered before, and it's starting to get into the mainstream a little bit. Kansas City Star reporter asked Bill Self about player compensation, and Bill said the reality of it is it's big, big business, it's big money, and everyone is looking to make something out of it. Whether it's scouting services, AAU programs, shoe companies, universities, you could look at all areas, and the reason people are in the business is to try to make money. Does this represent progress to you? That have coaches been talking like this for a while, or do you think that maybe it's finally starting to get some more recognition, the inequalities in the sport?
Well, I think Bill Self is a coach who has a lot of confidence. He is not a coach that takes under consideration maybe some of the kind of political the political landscape of what he says. So he has a tremendous amount of leverage. He's been one of the most successful coaches in college basketball. He does a tremendous job of recruiting every year. Every year his teams are sniffing around the Elite Eight, Final Four. He also has a kind of personality. I don't know him, but he just strikes me watching him on TV that he's a kind of edgy, close to the players guy. And, so I think he's being relatively honest. I mean, if you look at you take a look at those comments, basically he is saying everybody is making money except the labor force itself. And I think he's implying that, is that necessarily fair? And that this idea that amateurism is what is keeping this together, amateurism only applies when you start talking about the players, because you use that as a justification to not give them what they're worth. And if you start having to do that, that's going to probably take away money from some other areas. And so, I mean, I appreciate his frankness. I think he went right up to the line. I mean, he's not going to, say that probably college players ought to be compensated straight out. He may even go as far as to say, well, maybe their grant aid needs to be increased because of all of the demands and so on and so forth, as everybody else is kind of done when they're asked these kind of questions. Or they take the safe route of saying, well, these young men are getting an education or whatever the case may be. So I have to give him some credit with a certain level of honesty, because when you look at coaches' salaries, when you look at the amount of money that this tournament generates, and it generates a tremendous amount of money for the NCAA. And you start talking about staffers and all of the scouts and everybody else that's connected with March Madness. You know, the one group of individuals that are providing the service are getting really kind of pennies in comparison to the other individuals that are connected, the adults. And so it's not really a fair situation. I think he is someone that's unusual, again, that's saying, hey, you know, this is really kind of problematic. And if you look at it in a kind of moralistic, logical way, in a lot of ways, it's really kind of wrong. But that's the system. And, you know, for the most part, until those players get themselves organized into some kind of maybe formal structure, union, whatever the case may be, you're going to see the same thing happening. As long as you can get something in which you can pay a little or nothing for, you're not going to want to increase the compensation of that service. And that's been the nature of the way things have played themselves out in this country.
Yeah, also in this article is Jim Boeheim, who makes $2.15 million. That's his salary for 2018. And he said that players could get maybe a $1,200 to $1,500 a month stipend. But I read somewhere else, I think it was in a more academic, the Chronicle of Higher Education, this is also cited in the Star article, they said that the revenue could be the same as it was 10 years ago as far as between the, you know, quote-unquote grown-ups in college sports. And you could still pay the highest level elite college athletes $750,000 a year. So do you think we'll get somewhere in between there? What's, you know, if you had a crystal ball, do you think?
Happen until the players themselves. If you look at the history of labor relations in this country, the only time that there have been concessions to labor has been when labor has forced those concessions to take place. And they understand very clearly that college athletes are in a very, very difficult kind of negotiating position. First of all, they're not like professional athletes because they change every 3 to 4 years, and they only have a short window in terms of the opportunity to provide the service that they provide. They have not necessarily matured intellectually. When you're 18 to 22, you don't understand the complexities of many of the things that you're involved in. And so it will take someone probably being able to provide leadership that they would have a certain sense of trust. And so it's a very, very rock-solid kind of exploitive system that's in place right now because of the nature of the young men's ages and them not having a certain kind of sophistication to be able to digest all of the complexities of this, and nor being able to kind of take that chance because of the pressure that they have from their family members to go and play college basketball and not do anything to potentially sabotage that by going on strike or speaking out or anything like that, because everyone thinks that they have this opportunity to make that next step to professional basketball. And so, you know, colleges are going to continue to do some of the things that they've been doing, and this tournament is going to continue. And, you know, the next probably aspect of it is going to be just like what we have in college football, is that they will maybe slowly expand maybe the number of teams, kick those number of teams up to maybe 70, 75 or something like that, have a few more so-called maybe play-in games or whatever the case may be, and, you know, continue to generate revenue without trying to, you know, kick any of that kind of revenue, any kind of meaningful way back to those players.
All right. I think we're going to have to wrap it up there, but thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Ross, professor of history at Ole Miss. Great analysis today, and have a great rest of your day.
All right, you too, and hopefully your Kansas City Chiefs will have a very rock-solid season in 2018.
I hope so, too. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Take care.
Bye. We will rock.
sports fans. March is Brain Awareness Month. My name is Chris Mann, and I'll be reviewing the book After the Cheering Stops by Cindy Fiesel. Cindy writes, After the Cheering Stops is a close-up and personal look at the life and death of Grant Fiesel, who was the starting center and long snapper for the Seahawks from 1987 to 1992. While in the National Football League, Grant was just another anonymous offensive lineman who toiled in the trenches, banging up his battered body with every snap of the ball. His helmet-to-helmet collisions opened the door to brain trauma that impacted his thought processes, accelerated his physical deterioration, and altered his personality. This brain trauma is now known as CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Other names for this condition are post-concussion syndrome or mild traumatic brain injury. Cindy describes Grant at the beginning of their relationship and then describes him as totally different at the end of Grant's life. She recalls, Grant made no bones about the fact that his studies were very important to him because he was a pre-med student. He was just as competitive for top grades as he was competitive on the line of scrimmage. He was accepted at all of the medical schools that he applied to. Grant wasn't a party guy. He didn't have time to waste on drinking and carousing. While in college, Grant was picked for the NFL draft. In training, Cindy found out that football was a 6 to 7 day a week work schedule. Grant would come home icing bloody injuries and in pain. He brought home pills in baggies. At one point, Cindy asked him about the pills. What are they for? Grant replied, Everything hurts. The team doctor gave them to me when I told him I was in pain. After he became a starter, Grant began receiving numbing Marcaine injections before the game. The use of painkiller shots only minutes before the opening kickoff was pervasive in pro football, Grant said. Everyone does them. If it wasn't for these shots, a lot of players wouldn't be able to suit up. When Grant retired from the NFL, he was 32 years old. Within months of retiring, Grant never went a day without alcohol and had become addicted to prescription painkillers. Cindy writes that we were both clueless about how the collisions and concussions from playing football had addled his mind to the point where their marriage would be ruined, our family destroyed, and Grant will die. After Grant died from alcoholism, his brain was sent to the Concussion Legacy Brain Bank in Boston. He had stage 3 CTE. Stages are listed at 1 through 4, with 4 being the most serious. Recently, NFL player Corey Weidman refused induction to the Montana Football Hall of Fame, citing that football had destroyed his life through numerous concussions, bringing on symptoms of CTE. Grant Fiesel's last words to his wife were, If I'd only known that what I loved the most would end up killing me and taking that away everything I loved, I would have never done it. Do you have to play professional football to get CTE? New evidence is showing that concussions are evident in all contact sports. Does CTE set in only after you play these sports professionally? No. Untreated concussions cause CTE, and it begins in youth sports. Fans, parents, players, and all people who love sports. Sports can be played without crippling the players. Rules have to change, and the health and well-being of the sports players needs to take front and center. Read After the Cheering Stops by Cindy Fiesel and research this well. Sports franchises are corporations, and they allow for injuring and maiming players for profit. If your child plays sports, his or her life and well-being are at stake. Do not let the repetitive concussions rock you or your child. This is Chris Mann. Thank you for listening.
Now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Tino?
Meet a Muslim at Dialogue Institute of the Southwest Kansas City on Sunday, April 1st, 2 to 4 p.m. Dialogue Institute of Kansas City, 4215 Shawnee Drive, Kansas City, Kansas, 66106. And you can RSVP to the Dialogue Institute on Facebook.
Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee monthly meeting, Tuesday, April 3rd, 6:30 p.m., All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri.
And the March and Rally for Peace, taking action on the 50-year anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Friday, April 6, 2018, 5:30 p.m. march and a 7 p.m. rally. It's at 34th and Paseo, Victorious Life Church, to 7th and Prospect. Rally will begin at 7 p.m. at Morningstar Baptist Church, 2411 East 27th Street, Kansas City, Missouri.
Heartland Alliance for Progress, How the KC Budget Addresses Constituent Needs with Council Members Alyssa Kennedy and Teresa Lohr. Monday, April 9th, 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Californos, 4124 Pennsylvania.
Anand Bhatt, medical doctor, will be talking about four major health systems in the world, how they work, and how much they cost. After the presentation, they'll talk about a nationwide movement for Medicare for All. And that is going to be Wednesday, April 4th at 6:30 p.m. to 8 o'clock p.m. at the Kansas City Public Library.
Which library? Do you know?
Kansas City Public Library at the Westport Branch.
The Westport Branch.
Yes.
Okay. All right. And civil disobedience training for the Poor People's Campaign. Saturday, April 14th, noon to 2 p.m., Westport Presbyterian Church, 201 Westport Road, KCMO. RSVP to Stand Up KC on Facebook. That's it for our calendar. You can find our calendar on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can find our archived shows as well as our upcoming schedule. Tune in next week on the Heartland Labor Forum when we're going to be doing Lives on the Line Story Slam. These are stories from fast food workers and other low-wage workers, and an event last February that we're going to be rebroadcasting. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.